regulations, so I was happy to get out of there early. So was Senator Brown and Senator Benson. It was tough. We have a very good agenda today. We're doing the Renewable Energy Standard Cost Compliance Report Review. If you remember, members, we had that in our omnibus bill last year, and we're just going to have a review on Senator Hayden, you're over there. Senator, you're in energy utilities.
Poor guy.
It's been a long week. So last year in May 27th, actually, Governor Dayton signed the Senate File 1197, which included a variety of the energy provisions, and among them was the requirement for the utilities subject to the RES to report the, quote, rate impact of activities of the electric utility necessary to comply with sections 216B.1691. So the utilities were to determine their additional cost, if any, for the ratepayers paid for their utilities to comply with this RES during the 2007 to 2010 time frame. So with that, we are going to start off with the co-ops today. We have John Brecky, the Vice President of Member Services from Great River Energy, and Joel Johnson, Minnesota Rural Electric Association. If you both can come up, I'd appreciate it. Please state your name for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Brecky. I'm the Vice President of Member Services with Great River Energy.
Welcome, Mr. Brecky. And Mr. Johnson,
welcome. Joel Johnson with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association.
Thank you. Great. Go ahead.
Thank you.
Please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my presentation has been circulated and set in front of you. It's got a blue title slide. Great River Energy is on the title slide. We appreciate the opportunity to have a dialogue with you today about our filing of the Renewable Energy Standard Rate Impact on Great River Energy and its member cooperatives for the year 2010. Great River Energy serves 28 member distribution cooperatives who in turn serve about 1.7 million Minnesotans who are consumer owners of those cooperatives. The land area covered by those co-ops covers over 60% of the area of Minnesota, land area-wise, and into a small part of northwestern Wisconsin. We have 3,000 megawatts of generation, and we own and operate 11 power plants fueled by various sources, coal, natural gas, and a little bit of fuel oil. In addition to that, we have 469 megawatts of wind, and we're going to be talking about wind in my report today. Those wind assets are contracted to GRE. We buy the output of those wind farms. There's 8 wind farms that are in our portfolio, and 6 of those are located in the state of Minnesota. Let's talk a little bit about our reporting approach that we used for GRE's filing. And we first want to acknowledge there are several different ways that cost impacts could be estimated for the renewable energy standard for any given utility. And none of those methods are perfect. And it's sort of like asking the question, what would the world be like if the world wasn't like it is? And anytime you ask a question like that, you can get a varied a set of answers, each of which can be viewed as reasonable and defensible. And I'll talk about the method that we used and the reasons why we chose our method for reporting the cost impacts on the ratepayers and member owners of GRE and our member cooperatives. One thing the stakeholders did agree on in our filings was to use 2010 as the base year. Outside of that, there wasn't a lot of agreement on how to calculate the rate impact. But there were commonalities among the filings of the cooperatives, of course. GRE's report provides a snapshot of the market conditions that we experienced in 2010 that directly impacted our member rates. Future markets with different dynamics would have far different impacts or could have far different impacts on our members. And we certainly understand there could be potential long-term benefits of the renewables in our portfolio under different market conditions, and we'll measure those and monitor those as we go forward. But we've got to live with the realities of the market today, which is a very soft wholesale market for electricity for utilities that are selling into that market. The advantage of our method primarily is that it's objective. It relies on actual data. actual settlement statements that come from the Midwest ISO marketplace and not averages. We used actual revenue data from our wind farms. We can do more subjective analysis of wind and renewables in our portfolio, and we will do that in our IRP filings. Our next integrated resource plan filing to the state Public Utilities Commission will occur this fall. Now, turning to page 2, talking a little bit about our resource needs at GRE, and I want to first mention that our renewable energy portfolio is 469 megawatts, and that portfolio, the decisions regarding the wind farms that we added to that portfolio were driven by state policy and not by load growth. We haven't experienced much of any load growth in our system since 2007, and we've added over 400 megawatts of wind in that time in response to state policy and the goals and objectives of the state of Minnesota through the renewable energy standard. What we find and what we conclude that it is easier to fold in new resources, including wind and other resources, in an environment of load growth. And in that environment, we can look at wind as a substitute for potential other new resources that we might otherwise add. Certainly the economics of wind are more favorable when you compare them to other new resources that you might add, versus comparing them to the opportunity cost of a marketplace today that is very soft, very low prices in the wholesale market. So if we had needed to add new resources, then certainly it would have made sense to compare wind to other resources and conclude what savings or extra costs you might glean from adding wind versus those other resources. But that wasn't the decision for GRE. The decision really was driven by state policy of adding these new wind resources now while we could get production tax credit value and recognizing that we had a mandate to meet that ramps up through 2025. The other thing I want to point out is that we won't need to add additional wind to our portfolio until after 2020. So sometimes we get asked the what if question, what if the renewable energy standard went away for a utility like GRE? And even if it did go away, it would have little to no impact on GRE until after 2020. We've signed long-term agreements for wind to get us out to around 2025, close to that, before we need to add other wind or other renewable resources. Turning to our cost components in our filing covering the year 2010, the costs fall into three categories. And the primary category was related to generating resource costs. These are the power purchase agreement payments that we pay to the wind developer, the wind owner and operator, for the output of the wind farm. And we compare that to actual market value of energy at those locations. So it does measure for us an opportunity cost and a direct cost of buying that wind energy. And a lot of times people ask us, well, if you're short on energy, how does the market affect you? If we were short the hours, in other words, we didn't have enough energy in the hours that the wind is being produced to meet all of our member load growth, then we have an opportunity cost issue because we're buying from the wind farm at our average price of about $40 a megawatt hour when we could be buying from the market an average price of about $16 a megawatt hour. So even if we don't have enough resources to meet the load in that particular hour, let's say we've got a maintenance outage at one of our power plants, we still have the opportunity cost issue of being able to buy from the market at a $16 price versus buying from our wind farms at $40. Transmission costs were also included to the extent that they directly relate to the renewable energy standard in Minnesota. We did not include regional transmission expansion costs in that filing. And then finally, administrative costs, which are largely related to legal costs and the Minnesota Renewable Energy Tracking System costs that we are assessed for the participation in that program. Turning to the next page, we've got a graph that might illustrate nicely the inverse relationship that utilities face relative to the output of wind farms and the price or value of that wind in the market. So the LMP line that you see is really a value line. What is the value of that energy in the hour that it is produced? And we've stacked that against the average output of a wind farm, in this case, the Elm Creek Wind Farm, which is a 100-megawatt facility near Tremont, Minnesota, and we buy all the output from Elm Creek. The average hourly value of wind, the LMP line, in the very wee hours of the morning is around $15 a megawatt hour. And it ramps up to about $35. The peak is around $40 for average, and then down again to that $25 down to $15 price late at night. So you could see that during the daytime when businesses are using a lot of energy and in the late afternoon when homeowners are using a lot of energy, the prices do go up in that market. The value of energy is higher. But the wind curve is the inverse of that. In other words, we get a lot of output from our wind farms in the wee hours of the morning, less during the day, and it ramps up again as usage comes down later on. So we get more output from our wind farms when the value of that output is less. And a lot of people talk about the opportunities for storing that energy, and there's two main barriers to storage that we see right now. One is it's very, very costly to build storage. And with low natural gas prices, you don't have as much of an arbitrage opportunity. In other words, the on-peak prices of electricity are kept low by low natural gas prices. So you're not able to arbitrage it enough to cover the capital cost of storage. The other problem is the seasonal issue. What we've shown here is an average daily graph. But if you look at the seasonal issue, it's even more concerning. Because our wind farms tend to produce more in the spring and the fall when electric energy usage is lighter. There's not as much heating and air conditioning going on, of course. And storage doesn't help you with that issue. You can't store energy cost effectively in the spring and use it in the summer. So that's an even greater concern than the daily concern. Now, there's 10,000 megawatts of wind in the MISO market. GRE is 469 megawatts of that, and folks have said, and the Department of Energy Resources has said, that our method ignores the market price impact of wind in lowering the cost of the energy that we have to buy from the market to serve our load. Well, that 10,000 megawatts of wind in MISO to us wasn't driven by Minnesota's RES. What was driven by Minnesota's RES for us was our 400 megawatts of wind. And what's driving the price in MISO is over 10,000 megawatts of wind. That all tends to blow at about the same time. There's a high degree of coincidence factor. So if GRE somehow didn't have this mandate, hadn't added the 400 megawatts of wind, we could have taken advantage of a 9,600 megawatt MISO strong wind portfolio, bought energy at low prices, and benefited from that more than we are through our wind portfolio in the current market. The next chart shows market prices versus power purchase agreement prices, and if you look at this chart,
excuse me.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Do you want to,
Senator McGuire?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can I ask a question now, or should I wait till the end? That was really sort of unclear what you just said. So
oh, thank you.
I'm sorry. No, no.
No, I mean, thank you for raising the question.
It was unclear
to me. Could you,
Senator McGuire?
Thank you. Could you say that again? What you just said about if you hadn't had to use the RES, you could have used something else. Could you just say that
again?
The
current market, Mr.
I could.
Thank you,
Senator. Thank you for your question, and I am moving quickly to try to get through in the time allotted,
yes,
and so
I'm
probably
sorry.
Glossed over that too quickly. The point that we want to make relative to our method, and it's really in defense of choosing this method, is related to the Department of Energy Resources comments about the fact that the addition of wind in the market has pushed down prices and allowed us to buy from the market at times that the price is reduced because of all the wind. In other words, there's more supply available, prices are lower, we can buy to serve our load at lower prices. Well, those prices in the market are driven by the fact that there's 10,000 megawatts of wind. And if we didn't have the mandate and weren't buying from the wind farms at a power purchase agreement contract price around $40 a megawatt hour, we could be buying from the market at around $16 a megawatt hour instead. And it creates an opportunity cost of roughly $24 a megawatt hour in the current market. Now, that could change, and we'll measure that for every year, but certainly that was the case for 2010. And that's the issue that we're raising.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So there was a contract, and I know I'm coming, late to this whole issue, but so there was a contract that was set up so that would that required you to buy at
yes.
that price, and that probably did that make it possible for them to build the wind farms and everything. That price is contracted. So now that they're built, now we can get energy cheaper. I'm going to have to think about this a little bit more.
Madam Chair and Senator McGuire, that is exactly correct. And in order for wind farms to get financing and to build their project, it's important that they have some revenue certainty. Yeah. And we provide that revenue certainty through the power purchase agreement that requires us to pay about $40 a megawatt hour for the energy.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Metzen.
Yeah, power purchase agreement and the 40 to 16 is the 16, aren't there tax incentives and tax credits? Is that apples to apples or not?
Mr. Brickey.
Madam Chair, Senator, the $16 price is the average of what we saw for 2011, and that's the market value of the energy. The $40 price includes the benefit of the tax credits, so that's embedded in the $40. Without the tax credit benefit to the wind developer, they would have to charge us more than $40 for the wind, and the difference would be greater.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Brecky, how long is the term of your power purchase agreement?
Madam Chair, Senator, the terms vary. We have some agreements that are as low as 15 years in duration, and our longest agreement is 30 years in duration.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brecky, if I may follow up, is that 15 years from today or 15 years from inception? I guess, what is the term left?
Thank you.
Mr. Brecky.
Madam Chair, Senator, the term left on our shortest agreement for our one of our large wind farms would be through 2020, and that was a 15-year deal that was struck as of 2005. So that's the shortest agreement. The longest agreement would run 30 years from 2010. It would be about 2040 when that one would expire.
Senator Hayden, did you have your hand up? No.
Sure.
Senator Harrell.
Madam Chair, when you talked about that it didn't include the tax credit, can you tell us what the value of those tax credits are, an average value of those tax credits? So if they would have charged more, you said they're charging $40. What's the tax credit? How much is it?
Mr. Brickey.
Madam Chair, Senator, the value that we see in our wind contracts runs about $19 a megawatt hour, so somewhere around $59 a megawatt hour. Now, it depends on how much impact on the market the PTC had in itself. Maybe it drove up demand for wind farms, and so the difference isn't quite that great. But if you just look at the PTC value, it's about $19 a megawatt hour.
Thank you.
Mr. Brecky, my question is this report just based off your figures of 2010, or does it go back to 2007?
Madam Chair, this report is for 2010 only. It's a snapshot of that year.
I do believe they found in 2009 and 2010 the renewables were generally more expensive as the downturn of the economy. But in 2007 and 2008, they were less expensive. Mm-hmm. So that's something that is a generalized comment. We have 14 different entities that submitted reports, and I'm not sure if they all just concentrated on 2010 or if some went back to 2007, 2008 to look at it as a whole. But that is something just to keep in the back of your mind, members.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we believe that the stakeholder group came to an agreement that we wanted to file a snapshot for 2010. So we believe that that's what most folks did. But the next chart does show you the impact on market prices versus PPA prices over time. And if the market returns to the levels that we saw in 2007, 2008 at some future point, then the cost of this mandate on GRE and our members will be reduced. And we'll have to see how that plays out. But keep in mind that in 2007 and 2008, there was not 10,000 megawatts of wind in MISO. There were maybe 1,000 megawatts of wind in MISO at that time. So could we return to a market like that? It'd be more difficult to return to that market because there's a lot more wind now. And certainly natural gas prices will be a driver of that market. Turning to the final page, our report findings are listed here in terms of relative impact of the various categories, but the big driver is the cost of the power purchase agreements, the direct generating resource cost, $22 million of if you compare the cost of the wind to the value of the wind in our portfolio, was a $22 million difference in cost on GRE. That difference grew as of 2011, and our filing covered 2010, but I might note for you that since we just completed the year 2011, I will state that we estimate that that generating resource cost in 2011 is closer to $38 million. We had more wind in our portfolio as of 2011, and the prices got worse in the market. The value of the wind energy went down in the market. So about $38 million in 2011. Now, the rate impact on an average consumer who uses about 1,000 kilowatt hours a month is roughly $2 a month, $24 per year cost impact of the renewable energy in our portfolio. And that is an opportunity cost impact. So our goal was to keep the report simple, supported by financial results that could be compared year to year. We believe our method made sense for GRE for a couple of reasons. One is we wouldn't have added wind but for the state policy relative to renewable energy. And so it did make sense to look at wind versus market rather than new resources, because we weren't going to add new resources except for state policy. The second thing about our method that we think makes sense is that the market prices are driven lower by the 10,000 megawatts of wind in MISO that all tend to produce output at about the same time. They have a high coincidence factor, in other words, and not driven. The market prices were not driven by our 400 megawatts of wind. They were really driven by the aggregate amount of 10,000. Our next IRP is filed this fall, and we will evaluate longer-term RES impacts in that filing. And staff did provide us with some hypothetical questions that they asked us to consider, and if there's time, Madam Chair, I'll go into those now.
Please.
Thank you. The report is a look backwards, but let's talk about the hypothetical questions from the staff. And the first question was, what if the power production tax credit were allowed to expire and not renewed by the federal government? The first thing that would occur is future wind agreements would be more expensive for utilities like GRE. But the problem with that is we're not planning to add any more wind till after 2020 or other renewables till after that time. We are good. We're covered through probably 2025, and so we would need to add wind a couple years before that, perhaps 2023 or so. So even if the PTC expired, it would have no impact on GRE from a power purchase agreement perspective. The PTCs in the existing agreements would still be in place. And one could make the argument that since we don't need more wind, and more wind being added to the market is going to drop the value of existing wind even lower, that anything we do to encourage more wind to be added to the market through PTC is going to make the existing wind less valuable to GRE and our members. So one could make the argument that an extension of the PTC could actually hurt GRE in the short run, in the next 5 to 10 years, which is the opposite of what you might expect. Another question they asked us is, what happens if there's carbon regulation? Carbon regulation would have an immediate impact if there were carbon costs on coal-fired generation, since there is so much coal in the MISO market, 70% or so coal generation, it would have an immediate impact on the market and driving up the market price. If the cost of carbon was $10 to $15 per ton, it might add that to the megawatt-hour price in the market and make wind more valuable. So if carbon has a cost, wind looks better relative to the other resources in the market, and it would offer us savings on the wind. Of course, it would cost us on our coal portfolio, but it would benefit us on the wind, on the existing wind that we have. Another question they asked is, what if we could count large hydro or other renewable resources that are not now designated as renewable in Minnesota? And this could be a possible benefit, but it'd be probably a post-2020 benefit. We don't need to add other resources. We've got enough now to get through 2022 or three. So it wouldn't benefit us till then. But generally, what we would say is that the more choices we have to meet the renewable energy standard, the better off we're all going to be in the market.
Mr. Brecke, do you Thank have you. Those responses, those questions and responses printed that you could gather and get out to the members?
Madam Chair, they're printed in my handwritten notes at this point, but certainly we will type those up and provide those for your information.
That'd be wonderful. And maybe just a little summary above that, too?
Yes.
Yeah, of your findings?
Madam Chair, we will do that.
That'd be great. And, Mr. Brecky, could you just, again, explain that this is 2010 filings, and that was the committee got together with the chamber, everybody, to say we're just going to focus on 2010. Explain that a little bit, would you please?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The stakeholder group discussed the filing and the methodology behind the filing, and you know, folks came to different conclusions on how to calculate the costs. But one thing that we seem to have general consensus on is using 2010 as the base year for the filing and filing the costs for that year.
Any other questions, members?
Well, Madam
Senator
Chair.
McGuire.
Thank you, Madam.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'll get you next.
Oh, okay. I'll go because then I'll probably have another one after you. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick one just so I understand what we were looking at here. You said on your chart that there was an inverse relationship between the wind and market energy. Or what's in the market. But you said that the more wind is produced when there's less needed, but there's pretty much stable wind, right? It's just that sometimes we need less of it. So it's not that inverse is more like that. I mean, it's really that we have stable wind and that sometimes we just need less of it, right?
Mr. Brecky.
Madam Chair,
Senator.
Inverse would be more of an opposite. It's not really opposite. It's just we just need less wind sometimes.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator. That's a good question, and I wouldn't state it exactly the way that you did.
Okay.
The red line is the average output. The red line on that graph is the average output of our wind farm for the year, so it's smoothed. If you look at a daily output graph, it would be very, very much more volatile. You know, there'd be hours where there'd be no output from the wind, hours where there'd be full output from the wind farm. And so the average varies between, on this chart, 26 megawatts or so and up to somewhere in the 30s. And so that is a smoothed line for the year. And as you can see, on average, we get less wind output during the daytime hours when people are using more electricity than we do at night. And that surprises a lot of people who are used to summertime hours when they feel like it's windy during the day and it calms down at night. But if you look at the year as a whole, when we have many very cold months when people aren't outside at night to feel it, but there's more wind output for the year at night than there is during the day. So that's the inverse relationship that we talk about. The daily graph would be a lot more volatile.
Okay. And so,
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to understand, so when there's more input, does it not go on the grid and then we can use it anytime, or do I just not understand the grid?
Mr. Brecky.
Madam Chair, when there's more output from the wind farm, what will have to happen is one of two things. Either there'll be enough load to absorb that wind, or you'll have to back down other forms of generation to make room for it. And so we are seeing that during nighttime hours, especially in the spring and fall. You will see this market say, you know, we don't need certain coal plants to operate. There's enough other resources to take care of the need with the wind that's been added. So one thing that is true about wind being added to our market is there is less operation of coal plants and natural gas plants when the wind is producing energy. And we can think of an example, a summertime example, where 2 days side by side on our system, one day had a lot of wind, one day didn't. The day that we had a lot of wind output, the temperature was about the same. And our peaking plants, our gas-fired peaking plants, were not called on by the market to operate. The following day, when the wind died down, our peaking plants did operate and serve the market. So it does displace other resources in the market, and we are seeing that.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Senator McGuire.
I'll just try one more then. So you said that we don't need to add more wind until 2020. Does that mean we don't need to add any more energy at all? No more coal plants, no more anything? Because we don't need any more energy on the grid till 2020. Am I just understanding what you said,
Mr. Brecky?
Madam Chair, Senator, that comment was related to the mandate level. We won't need to add any more renewable energy resources for purposes of meeting the mandate until after 2020. We've got enough to get us through probably 2025, but we don't want to go right up to the date and then all of a sudden have an emergency. So we would add something after 2020, maybe around 2023 for meeting the mandate. Now, coincidentally, we also don't need other resources, we don't think, until about 2020. Now, a lot of that will depend on the economy and economic growth on our system and load growth. But at the current time, we have enough energy and capacity to meet our members' needs for the next 10 years.
So we wouldn't have to add any other energy.
Right. Not at Great River Energy. We're not planning to at this time.
Senator Cantor.
Mr. Brenke, of course this is driven by state policy. It sounds like if the state hadn't done what we did here, you wouldn't be out there helping us on the renewable situation. I mean, we're trying to clean things up and lessen our dependency, and we need all of our providers helping out. I understand the economics of it, but there's other issues, too, that we're all in this as a team, and the bigger other companies have to do this also. So that's why you're not left off the hook, and you have to help the environment too, you know. So, and it sounds like, and I understand economics, that's what I kind of do for a living, but I mean, the other flip of the coin is we want you and the other companies to be equal partners in this renewable stuff.
Madam Chair, Senator, I would just point out that even when the renewable energy standard was an objective, it was a goal of the state.
Yeah, that's back.
GRE added 100 megawatts of wind at Trimont through a power purchase agreement in a good faith effort on that objective as well. So we certainly agree that we want to be partners.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds like you were too much complaining and not part of the helping out the situation. So,
Senator Mason, I think they've done a good job in my district. I serve the Trimont area. I put a tremendous amount of wind farms down in there, and it's added jobs and the property tax base, the whole bit. So greatly appreciate it. We are going to have to keep moving. Thank you, very much, Mr. Brecky, for coming. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All of the members should have a copy of my presentation, RES Rate Impact Reports for Minnesota Cooperatives. I'm going to really try to breeze through this. John touched on most of the technical natures of it. There are six generation and transmission cooperatives that supply power to co-ops in Minnesota. In addition to GRE, Dairyland Power, Minn Kota Basin, East River, and LNO Power. To make a note, Basin supplies most of the power to East River and LNO, and they filed a joint report in this area. Like GRE, Dairyland and Minn Kota took the snapshot approach, comparing their power purchase agreement prices with the market and other related costs. And also like Dairyland, Dairyland and Minn Kota have been really aggressive when it comes to meeting the renewable generation to meet the RES. Just for example, Minn Kota, with a single power purchase agreement, is pushed their wind portfolio to over 30% of their entire portfolio. And Dairyland is also well ahead of the RES right now. With that being said, the cost impacts have been pretty significant for both Dairyland and for Minn Kota. Dairyland calculated a 6.6% wholesale rate increase based on the marginal increased cost of renewable versus the conventional generation. And they did that on the basis of they would likely not have bought as much renewables had it not been for the RES. Minn Kota calculated a 15.81% wholesale rate increase based on the estimate of what the 2010 rate would have been without the cost of complying with the RES. Factors that have impacted costs for both Dairyland and Minn Kota are, again, I mentioned they're both ahead of the curve, which means that more of the costs are up front. They won't be having the development costs further on down the road. Market conditions. when most of the power purchase agreements were signed back in 2007, they looked like really, really good deals. When the market collapsed over the past couple of years, suddenly what they're paying for wind is significantly more than what they could be buying it on the open market.
Well, Mr. Johnson, that brings me to a question. Can we just call it Dairyland? Come on.
Oh.
my question is
I like Dairyland myself.
Explain the difference between Dairyland's 6.6% and Minn Kota's 15.81%, because there is definitely a story there, too.
And I think mainly it's in terms of the size of the investment that Minn Kota made.
I thought it was the timing, too, also. And the size of early on.
Yes, they went all in at once, Minn Kota did. And as I mentioned, it pushed them above 30% of their portfolio. So it has a bigger impact overall on their rates. With it all in one at one time, it's all the same deal,
right.
Whereas Dairyland has a little, different deals for theirs.
Thank you.
Some other things that John has already kind of touched on are load profiles and the relative lack of off-peak demand. And this is one thing that is affecting co-ops more. We don't have, and I'm sure you remember from last year's SIP discussions, we don't have the large commercial and industrial 24-hour loads that some of the other utilities do. And that makes it much harder for us to integrate the wind, particularly when it's blowing at night or in off-peak. Transmission costs have also been significant. And again, that's another probably one of the differences between the Minn Kota rate increase and the Dairyland. Minn Kota had to make a significant investment in transmission to bring the wind to market.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that kind of mitigates the costs for both of them is that the cost for meeting the Minnesota RES is spread across all of the member systems for these two co-ops, which means that consumers in North Dakota and in Wisconsin, Iowa, and Illinois are subsidizing somewhat the RES, the cost of the RES for Minnesota ratepayers. Basin took a different approach, and it's mainly reflected in the way that they've approached this. They have really not added renewable generation to meet the RES. They're also in a period, one of the few utilities that's experienced pretty significant load growth, particularly related to the oil boom in western North Dakota. So they've been adding generation, and they've been able to add some wind generation on their system and place it in places where they can really integrate it easily. There haven't been a lot of the transmission costs related, none of the wheeling costs. And as a result, they factored that there is no impact on rates because this is generation they would have added just under the normal course of
business. And they will
meet
their standards too, right? They will make the standard? They'll make
frame?
Okay.
Yeah. And they have a large enough system with varying renewable energy standards. They serve 9 different states and 135 different distribution co-ops. So they have a little more leeway in integrating the wind into that system. With that said, there have been some additional costs related to the addition of wind on basin system, and mainly last spring and summer, it cost them $1.8 million because they had to shut down some of their wind generation projects, which they own, which is kind of a different situation than it is for the other G&Ts in Minnesota. They own much of their wind generation rather than buying it through power purchase agreements. But they had to shut it down last year because of minimum generation alerts caused by all of the flooding on the Missouri River and all of the water that had to be released in the dams. And they have indicated that the cost of transmission to take whatever wind generation is going to be added to their system is going to increase significantly over the next few years. And just finally, some key points that I wanted to make that kind of we're finding that has impacted co-ops. And one is, and Senator Metz, this kind of goes to what you were talking about. Electric co-ops are different, and the RES is impacting us in different ways. So it may be the same standard, but it is proving for some of our systems to be more expensive than on other systems. And that has to do with the differences in our load profiles of when we have our peak demands and other factors such as that. We've taken different approaches to meeting the RES, and that has impacted the cost to our members. Some have been really aggressive. Others have taken a slower approach, and others have tried to just meet the RES just during the general course of adding generation. The other thing that I think is important to note is that forcing utilities to integrate new resources when demand is down makes it much more costly. It's a lot easier to integrate renewables when load is growing than it is, as we've found over the past few years. And then, when we're allowed to build the lowest cost options for generation, that ends up being better for our members and the most cost-effective approach. And then finally, transmission is going to be a key to this issue in the coming years, and it is something we need to continue to address. So, thank you.
Very good, Mr. Johnson. Any questions? Senator McGuire.
That took a long time.
I'm trying to think of how I, when I ask. Okay, so lowest cost options would give lower cost to your ratepayers. I get that. Lowest cost options is probably not so good for our environment, though we might have it be coal. Is it? What are the lowest cost options?
I'm not sure that that's the case.
I think, as
in Basin's case has pointed out, when you can, there are a number of opportunities or situations where wind is the lowest cost option, and that it will be added naturally to most of our portfolios because of that.
Oh, good. So if we,
yes, Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, if we, if we were to take some of the things off the plate, if we were to take some coal plants or things that were more harmful to our environment off that, we have enough capacity to add some of these renewable things like wind into it to have it be better for everything.
Can I let John answer that?
Mr. Brecky.
Madam Chair, Senator McGuire, with respect to the lowest cost options right now, certainly the lowest cost option that we would have to meet energy needs of our members today is natural gas-fired combined cycle plant.
Okay.
Natural gas is very inexpensive in the market. Capital costs are low. And we can use that plant to ramp up and down and meet our members' needs cost-effectively. And environmentally, it has a nice profile. So that would be the lowest cost option. But there, as Mr. Johnson has said, there are cases where folding in wind makes economic sense. Largely those cases, whether for natural gas or wind, those are going to be driven by load growth on our system, and we don't have load growth today to be able to fold that in.
Right. And Manager, just
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. Just, we don't have load growth because we have all these other things going, but if we ended some of these other things, we would have load growth if we ended some of these other things.
Madam Chair, Senator, the load growth is really driven by usage patterns of our members. And so if there's a lot of industrial development, not a lot of new housing development in our territory, then we're going to have more sales opportunities of selling energy and electric energy to those customers. And when we do that, eventually you get to the point where you have to add a new resource to supply that. And at that time, you look at your cost-effective options and choose one of them. Under that scenario, but we're not planning to be in that situation for probably close to 10 years.
Senator Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And perhaps you could just touch on, because we're talking about low cost, we're talking about gas, we're talking about wind. And I think Senator McGuire's question is getting a little bit at, well, if you could take off coal. But can you address the base load issue, which is not load growth is different than base load need.
Right.
And so it's not. It's not apples to apples. You can't just say, well, we'll exchange coal for wind. It doesn't exactly work like that. Is that correct?
Mr. Brecky.
Right. Madam Chair, Senator, that's exactly right. And with the coal plants that we have in our portfolio, they have very high fixed costs. And if you decide that you need to shut it down and make room for wind, you still have the fixed cost that you have to recover from the member owners of the cooperative. So that's why their costs will go up. They have to pay for the coal plant anyway. And, you know, the idea economically is you might as well run it because you have all the fixed costs invested in it. And so then if you add wind on top of that and take away from coal output, you're paying for two energy assets instead of one. And so it becomes more expensive. But we do realize the environmental benefit of, you know, there's no CO2 emissions with wind. We understand that.
Okay. Good questions. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Brecky, Mr. Johnson. All right. And so we have munis, the IOUs, and the chamber, and a few more things to do here. So for the municipals, we have Mr. Johnston, Director of Cooperative Development Agency Relations and Officer of Legislative and Regulatory Affairs for SMPA, Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. I hope you have a get paid a lot of money there. That's a big title, Mr. Johnston.
That right. was in, Madam Chair, that was in lieu of the money. Yeah.
Okay. So.
Yeah.
That's good.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. Just a very quick comment on SMPA because I think most of you know who we are. We've taken kind of a portfolio strategy to meet our RES requirements over the years. And so we've, you know, attempted to get kind of a mix of ownership, some PPAs, some owned units, some RECs. We've tried to look at different resource types. So we have some wind, we have some small hydro, we have some landfill gas, we have some waste to energy, but predominantly our resource needs from the RES standpoint are largely met by a single wind PPA. So we work on doing those. We have been recognized by the DOE and AWEA over the years for how we've approached getting wind on the system. Those of you who have seen me around for a lot of years know we were early promoters of biodiesel as an opportunity for that as well. We were early promoters of trying to get RECs into the stream and have been huge supporters of the Midwest Renewable Energy Tracking System. We've recognized for a lot of years the value from an emissions standpoint of adding renewable resources to our resource mix. That being said, we've never been shy about telling you where it cost and what it cost, and so we discuss those things as well. I'm going to try to just highlight a couple of, I think, very pertinent observations and maybe pick up on a couple of the things that the other gentleman said, and we can delve into things in some areas perhaps a little bit deeper. In looking at the response to the RES cost filing report, predominantly I think what I've seen is people saying not a lot of consistency in terms of methodology, therefore it's hard to compare, and kind of an overall question as it relates to kind of using that market-based methodology of comparing resource costs against the wholesale market cost. SMPA, in fact, used both methods in this process and found some interesting things in the process. So I think it's enlightening just in terms of how all of this works, and I'd like to talk about that quickly with you. First of all, we did use a market-based approach. The gentleman was right. As a stakeholder group, we talked about how we might be able to do this. I think one of the things that pushed people towards a market-based approach initially wasn't just that it was verifiable data. It was things that happened. It made a lot of sense. Frankly, there wasn't a lot of time between when you folks all passed a piece of legislation and a report was due in October. And it was a rather expeditious way to get at that, and it was helpful from that standpoint. All of that having been said, the primary charge that seems to be leveled against that is that it's a snapshot, that it's a current perspective on what's happening in the marketplace, and so therefore you're kind of ignoring the fact that what you might see as a loss today could in fact turn out to be a substantive benefit 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now. A legitimate concern, although I think the thing I would point out on that is that it doesn't invalidate the results. I mean, if you have a current situation such as we have at Southern Minnesota Power, and the cost differential between the market and what we're paying for this large PPA roughly equates to about $1 million a month in terms of a loss for that particular project. Just because we're not looking forward with that, it doesn't mean that those costs aren't real. And that those costs need to be ultimately borne by some sort of a ratepayer in the process. Now, why I feel pretty comfortable talking about all that is because we also took the integrated resource plan approach that was suggested, by folks in the process. Those of you who have seen me over the years know that I am a huge fan of integrated resource planning. I think it's an extremely good way to get at identifying what is a base set of least cost resources in a very expeditious way, and that it shows to the best of your ability the interplay that's going to take place between the various resources. So it kind of mitigates this snapshot sort of charge, if you will. However, I might suggest that that process and that modeling process is only as good as the forecast's ability to meet the future as it all unfolds. Well, what do I mean by that? Kind of a rhetorical question, but I'm not sure there's a whole lot of people sitting in this room that in 2007 or early 2008 would have ever predicted the sustained, prolonged, and low level of natural gas prices that we're currently experiencing. So in the integrated resource planning process, we're going to crystal ball our way 15 years into the future, and you need to do that. But we're supposed to be able to see 15 years into the future with a relative degree of accuracy. But on the other hand, I don't think anybody was seeing what we've seen happen with natural gas prices in terms of their level as well. So let's talk about a quick case in point here. We took our last integrated resource plan, which was a filing in July of 2009. And using that filing, we did the following. And it's kind of typically how you'd look at something in an integrated resource plan. We took one case, which included all of our resources, including all of the RES resources. And we determined what the, if you will, the net present value cost of that stream over the 15 years of the integrated resource plan was. And then we took another case where we did not have the RES resources inside that. Okay. And so that was replaced with other resources, and to avoid a whole series of questions on that, in our last integrated resource plan, the only resources that were in there were either natural gas driven or wind. Okay, so it wasn't like it was displacing, there was no fossil fuel discussion there with coal or anything. So it's really comparing those two things. Well, here's the interesting result in this. Okay, so when we did that case, the case with, but we're going to talk about this, the case with the renewable energy resources in it was showing a slight benefit to the agency, about $9 million across the 15 years, okay? In the scheme of things, $9 million across 15 years isn't a huge number. Annualized, it's about $900,000 on an annual basis. Well, the first thing you ought to be asking me at this point in time is, didn't you just explain that your market analysis showed you that you were losing somewhere between $10 and $12 million on an annual basis, and how does this square with a forecast that essentially was suggesting close to $1 million annual benefit to the process? Quite simple, it was the natural gas forecast. As we put this resource plan together in late 2008, before things came apart, we're using essentially the same natural gas forecast as the rest of the planet was. And so we started out with a natural gas cost of about $6.50 a million BTU that escalated over the term of the integrated resource plan to about a little over $10 a million BTU. Bottom line is, if you're comparing our wind costs against that level of gas cost, it doesn't look too bad. Okay? Shows a slight benefit. If we were comparing it against a $4 natural gas cost or something sub $4, not going to be the case. So that's a difficult thing to get your hands around. So basically, it's all about the assumptions, how they unfold, and kind of the interplay between the resources. One of the things that's been mentioned a couple times earlier, if there's a general observation that I could make across all of the reports, well, I shouldn't say all, a large number of the reports that were filed, kind of what you pointed out earlier. A generalized statement might be, if you were in that market early on, and kind of the 2005 to maybe even early 2008 range, the cost of the renewable resources probably looked pretty darn good, probably pretty competitive. In instances, may have showed a benefit, frankly. After 2009, not so good, because we're looking again at a different situation with regard to the alternative resources. We're in the process right now. Our next integrated resource plan is a July 2013 filing. And I could make a couple quick comments about, you know, the hypotheticals you mentioned, but I'm essentially on board with what the other gentleman said, so I'll save time on doing that for you. The one difference might be when you asked us the question of would large hydro make any difference. Where I would think, and I should put this in context too, we're good at the agency with our renewable resources through 2020. So you should understand that as a context. And most of the utilities in Minnesota are in the teens or approaching the 20s, so they're all pretty comparable from that standpoint. But the one thing that we might think differently about with regard to that is we might be interested in buying large hydro RECs. And why I say that is because it is not real possible to take delivery of energy from Manitoba Hydro. We've done some things with them over the years. Not real easy to get your hands around that because of the transmission constraints. But perhaps, I mean, in the work I do with MRETs, I'm very cognizant of the fact that there's all kinds of large hydro RECs in MRETs. So that's something that could be considered. So those kind of getting at your questions, but here's the questions we're asking ourselves that might fit into some of the things you need to be thinking about as well. So as we're beginning to try to get these assumptions right for the next go-around for the integrated resource plan process, we're asking our things like, as the economy has begun to recover, natural gas prices have continued to fall. One might think that's an unexpected event, especially if you're one of those people who believe that it's the economy that's driving natural gas prices largely. I don't find myself in that camp. So the question becomes, will the recovering economy cause natural gas and therefore LNP prices to raise? If so, how much? Because that's a very germane question. What impact does shale gas have on natural gas availability and price levels? Will there be environmental issues that will limit that supply? Or have we, as some might say, entered what some are calling the new golden age of natural gas that has a sustained sub-$4 natural gas price? Those would impact significantly what resources and how well they would compare. Currently, there's an unprecedented, at least in my time in the industry, discussion of building LNG facilities in the U.S. You might say, nah, we've talked about that before. One big difference. This time, we're not talking about building LNG facilities in the U.S. for the idea of importing natural gas to be able to sustain our natural gas need. People are talking about building LNG facilities in the U.S. to export U.S. natural gas to more lucrative markets in Europe and Asia. If that were to happen, what impact does that have in terms of natural gas price availability and ultimately LNP prices that we would see in MISO? Other question might be, will there be a breakthrough in storage technologies? Some folks have talked about that. Could there be breakthroughs in operating efficiencies or cost of renewable resources? I'm not so hopeful on that at the moment. Other things that would be helpful, because I want to talk just a minute here, on off-peak load. Some people have referenced that, but there's some nuances I think would be good for you to know. So those are the sorts of questions that we need to be looking at. What are the major takeaways of that? I think you need to look at as many approaches of valuing this resource as possible. I don't think one's right and the other one's wrong. I think they're both fraught with limitations. I think they both need to be utilized because they both give us a peek at a snapshot at what we're trying to get our hands around. And I would also say, again, don't discount the current market analysis. What it tells you, just because it's not forward-looking, I think you need to combine these things. But here's a tendency I think we all have. We have a tendency to forecast, move forward with that, and we don't have a lot of tendency to look back and see how things have performed relative to the forecast. This market cost comparison that many have talked about and most have utilized to some degree in the report, that's a valid consideration. The last thing I want to talk to you about quickly is a specific the issue was talked about in terms of the off-peak nature of this. I think it causes some interesting things to happen that you need to think about long-term. Quickly, probably almost any wind project you're going to look at is going to have the capability of producing at least 50% or more of its production in what MISO would call off-peak periods. Okay, so that's generally, others have described it as the wee hours of the day, but essentially it's anything other than 6 a.m. to 10 p.m., and of course it's on the weekends. Most of the production is there. During that period, the prices are roughly 50 to 60% of the on-peak prices, and you've heard people allude to that. So, I mean, I guess my caution is there are several things. You shouldn't look at an average LMP price for the state of Minnesota. It's got to be a function of the hub where the delivery is. You need to be very careful when you try to assess costs to not look at average costs. You need to track hourly LMPs and the cost of the product that it is you're working with to try to get a good fix on that. The last thing I want to talk about in that area is something very, very interesting.
Mr. Johnson, we're going to have to – we have three more. Okay. So we'll have to – and I know you sent out a handout on that too, didn't you? So if you briefly could
I can, in fact, provide that.
Yeah, that would be great.
The interchange in those off-peak hours sometimes results in congestions and something that you've maybe heard of as negative LMPs, where MISO essentially says – we can't deliver. There's too much congestion. We're going to not pay you to deliver your product. We're going to charge you to deliver your product. So it will be an incentive to try to get you offline. We still encounter many hours of that. We try to work with our developers so that we can get them to shed load, but then we have to make up the cost of their lost PTC. So I think I'll end there. We can provide you some additional information on that. But if you've got questions, I'll be more than happy to entertain
them.
Any
questions for Mr. Johnston?
Great.
Thank you very much, Mr. Johnston. I appreciate it. Now we're going to do the IOUs. We have Mike Bull, the manager of the environmental policy for Xcel, and Julie Pierce, the manager of resource planning for Minnesota Power. Stay away from that tie, Senator Benson.
Yeah.
Step away from the tie.
Step away from the tie, yes.
Welcome, Mr. Bull, Ms. Ms.
Thank
Pierce.
You, Madam
Good
Chair.
To see you. I'm sorry, but hopefully some of this stuff that we've already covered some of the stuff, and you can give us your
Yes,
summary.
You have, Madam Chair. I think we'll be fairly brief. I'm Mike Bull with Xcel Energy.
I'm Julie Pierce with Minnesota Power.
Thank you.
Do you have any questions? No.
It's really good to have you back, Mr. Bull.
It's good to be back. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're very, very happy to be here today to talk about our implementation of the renewable energy standard and the analysis that we've undertaken. We thank Senator Benson and the committee for the good work that you all did last session in passing the legislation, and to the Minnesota Chamber for bringing that forward. We think these studies do provide a useful baseline for analyzing the rate impacts of the renewable energy standard. And I think we've had a very full discussion today, you guys have had, on the various ways to look at the ways to do that. Like most IOUs, we took it sounded like a somewhat different track than maybe the other folks thought of the stakeholder agreement. We looked at the question from two perspectives, looking backwards for historical rate impacts and then looking ahead for forecasted impacts, and reported on both of those. For Xcel Energy, put it in perspective, we operate about an 11,000-megawatt system north and south Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and a little bit of Michigan. We have about 1,600 megawatts of wind on our system currently. And we are well ahead of the RES through at least 2020, like other utilities have mentioned. The historical look under the rate impact study, our analysis showed that the wind on our system has had a beneficial impact for our ratepayers. The cost of our wind resources were an estimated 0.7% lower than our estimate of replacement energy capacity would have been. For that period. This wasn't unexpected in that we go to the commission for review and approval, prudence approval for each addition of renewable energy that we add to our system. So we have to flesh out what we do and why we're doing it each time we want to add something to our system. We've taken great care to ensure our customers receive value for their energy dollar. In addition to being cost-effective in their own right. The wind energy projects, for the most part, that we've added to our system have provided a great hedge against the high and volatile natural gas periods prices we had been experiencing. And you heard some testimony about this previously. Over the past decade, at some points those natural gas prices reached $12 and $14, and now they have collapsed, and they're forecasted to be significantly lower than that, $2, $3, $4 per MMBTU for the period going forward, and that has a lot to do with our forecasted impacts going forward. Looking ahead, it appears that renewable resources will have a more difficult time in the near future, both with the forecasted low natural gas prices and with the expiration of the wind energy production tax credit that's expiring at the end of this year. So with those assumptions, we project that our customers would pay approximately 1.4% more for energy over the next 15 years as a result of complying with the RES. So if we back off the assumption about the expiration of the PTC, and this was a question that you had raised earlier, Madam Chair, and we assume that PTC is extended through 2025, the rate impact of the RES for our customers would be about 0.7% higher than otherwise. Mostly to wrap up, because we've added low-cost, reliable resources to our system in time to take full advantage of those federal subsidies to the benefit of our customers, we're in good shape to see how the next few years pan out. We'll be able to comply, as I mentioned, with the RES through at least 2020 without adding additional resources, and we'll be pausing our renewable acquisitions for the time being while we let the market settle out and we get some clarity about what future renewable prices will be.
Mr. Bull, how much does a 1.4% rate increase for just an average residential ratepayer?
Madam Chair, I didn't do the actual calculation on the monthly bill, but I can get back to you with that.
Mm-hmm. That'd be nice to know. And for the 0.7%, if it,
yes, ma'am.
If you would.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sparks.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Mr. Bull. The previous three testifiers talked about that off-peak load and having a problem with that, taking more wind on, and it takes a while for them to either ramp up that base load in the morning or if they use their peakers. That's why I really look forward to the hearing we're going to have on the natural gas trends, because I think that's going to be very important. Is that an issue for you, the bigger the XLs or Minnesota Power?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the issue, we came at that market issue a little bit differently than it sounds like. We did have growing energy needs through the period, the forecast, the historic period we were looking at. So we were looking at, it sounded like Great River didn't need additional resources, and so anything they were required to add was a cost. For us, we did have energy resource needs, and so it was a question of whether we were going to add mostly natural gas generation, energy from natural gas generation, or energy from wind. And during that period, natural gas prices were higher, and so wind was more cost effective.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sparks? Members, anything else? Very good. Thank you, Mr. Bull. Ms. Pierce.
Yes, Madam Chair, Senators, thank you again for the opportunity. I'm on a little bit of a different side of the spectrum than Mr. Bull. Our system is 1,800 megawatts and approximately 11 million megawatt hours on an annual basis, so a little bit smaller, but we're very unique. We have a very large industrial and commercial class on our system that drives energy needs 24 hours a day. So our profile and our energy need is 24/7. And when we're growing, it typically is 24/7. So the addition of wind and other renewable resources, when they produce off-peak, it's very helpful for us. So as you read through our report, you might have seen that we were a little bit more positive on our reporting this time, because as we saw the energy growth, wind really fit well into our renewable portfolio. Throughout the current process, we did emphasize the importance of customer impact. Through our long-term planning process, as well as our interaction with our stakeholders and commission to get approval of each of our projects, we wanted to make sure that each of our projects were reasonable and cost-effective for our customers. And hopefully that's what you saw in our report. For us, the inclusion of the off-ramp provision in the legislation was very important as this was being developed. We wanted to have the opportunity to come to you if the costs were to get too high. And we're happy to report at this reporting process that we're not asking for implementation of that provision at all. This is mainly largely due to our unique access to the renewable resource market and some of the attributes of that market we've seen over the past 5 years. We made a strategic acquisition of a DC transmission line from North Dakota to Minnesota that allowed us some access to some very competitive wind in North Dakota. Through that, we also were fortunate enough to have very low turbine prices. So as we made the decision to build wind resources rather than buy them through long-term PPAs, we were able to take advantage of that renewable resource market and bring a very cost-competitive renewable portfolio to our customers. So looking backwards in our report, we looked at our renewable as a portfolio. And the projects that we've developed so far are about an average of $35 per megawatt hour. And we thought that would be a useful comparison as we look backward to 2007, 8, 9, and going forward. And with exception of the recent recession that has been spoken about a lot today, that portfolio price has been very competitive. And we see in our long-term planning that that will continue to be competitive over the lives of these projects. Looking ahead, we did do the long-term resource planning process to look at what our portfolio would be with and without an RES standard in Minnesota. And we did that in our last resource plan, making that very transparent for our stakeholders. And we found that the current RES levels are not creating additional burden on our resource portfolio. Again, we'll continue to look at that in our next resource plan in 2013, but right now we're not seeing any adverse impacts. Minnesota Power really believes that an optimized portfolio of renewables is very important for long-term cost competitiveness for its customers. A portfolio made up of wind, water, wood, and possibly even wavelength here as the markets come in, is going to be very beneficial. We've talked a lot today about the variability of wind and how do we fill that in with cost-competitive renewables. Well, you need a dispatchable or resource that can be there when the wind is not. So we're continually watching those markets. So again, we appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today. We'll continue to look at this reporting requirement and take any feedback and find ways to make this more useful in the future. Thank you.
Ms. Pierce, can you go jump a little bit farther into the different renewables that you're using?
Sure. Our portfolio right now, currently, we are the largest hydro producer in the state of Minnesota and have been for over 100 years. We have a pretty significant amount of biomass that we have on our system in partnership with many of our large industrial customers. And then, obviously, as of 2007, we've added about 400 megawatts of wind on our system. Largely, we built it, with the exception of one PPA that we implemented early on. And we are investigating solar on an ongoing basis.
All right. And you just looked at what were the years that you looked at again? Was it just 2010, or did you go back further?
No, our interpretation of the stakeholder discussion was that we would look backwards from 2007 through 2010 using the market-based comparison, and then from 2010 forward use the resource planning comparison. So we did both for the different time periods.
Excellent. Good. Thank you. Any other questions from members? Well, that was great. Thank you so much, Mr. Bull, Ms. Pierce. Appreciate it. And we have some comments from Ben Gerber, the manager. Excuse me? Oh, excuse me. No, Lauren Lotick. I'm sorry, from Ottertail. Lauren, it's right there on my sheet, and I...
It's online.
I never forget you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I want to thank Peter for indulging on me on your behalf so I could offer a few comments. For the record, I'm Lauren Lontuck from Otter Tail Power Company, and my comments will not be significantly different from either Minnesota Power or Xcel Energy. And for those of you in the committee who don't know who we are, we serve northwest and western Minnesota. Our current renewables are at about 15% of our total energy, and this gets us to compliance through about the year 2015. Unlike some of the other testifiers, we've actually seen some load growth on our system, and this has been largely a result of having oil pipelines. Oil pipelines are busy these days. We're expecting significant growth over the next several years as a result of oil pipeline increasing load. We serve several ethanol plants, and that's been a source of increased load. And finally, the ag economy has been very strong because ag prices are good. So we've seen energy growth as a result of that. So the bottom line for us is that we have an energy need both at the present time and going forward. And we've been able to add wind over the years at a very economic price. In fact, we contend that wind has been an economic addition for us, and that even in the absence of the renewable energy standard, we would have added wind, and we would continue to do so. In fact, in 2012, we will add one more 50-megawatt wind farm, and we're looking at another wind addition as a result of our integrated resource plan discussions with the Public Utilities Commission. So, again, like Xcel, we felt it was best to evaluate the RES over a 20-year window, not over a single year. And so our 20-year forecasted levelized cost for the wind that we've added to our system is a very economic choice compared to the other resources at this time. As I mentioned, we'll likely add another wind farm this year. All of the numbers or any of the facts I've tried to communicate to you are based on an assumption that the production tax credit has existed and exists through the end of this year. I do lobbying at the federal level for my company. I've been telling folks in my company the existence of the PTC is very much in doubt after the end of this year. I don't think we'll see it renewed, but I've been wrong before. And on the other hand, as the testifier from SUMPA pointed out, the price of natural gas is very competitive today and going forward, so all of the economics for these things will probably change to some degree after the end of this year. So that's all I've got. Answer any questions if you have any.
That's interesting.
Okay. Thank you.
To all the testifiers, too, if you wouldn't mind, just indulge me on this. It would be very interesting to have a brief summary of your comments, of your conclusions. I would really appreciate that, and we'll get that out to the members. And give us the years you looked at, if it was just 2010, if it was 07 to 10 and ongoing, or just kind of give us a parameter. I know we can get it from the department, but just this is for this simple mind here. Mr. Gerber from the Minnesota Chamber. There you are.
Chair.
Come up to the chair and get grilled,
Mr.
Gerber.
Mr. Gerber's coming up, but I think Mr. Lautog brought up a good point, and that's the production tax on wind. And maybe as part of your request to these companies, they could put into what the cost would be without the production tax for wind. Mm-hmm. If in fact Lauren is right and this goes out,
yeah, if that's doable,
because it kind of throws a wrench into the works here, and we need to think that through as part of our deliberations on a long-term economic efficient energy system here in the state. So
that's a very good point, Senator Magnus. Thank you. If you would mind do that, I'd appreciate it.
Yep.
Mr. Gerber.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, for giving me the opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Benjamin Gerber. I'm the Energy Policy Manager for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. You mentioned getting grilled. Someone told me I should start off my first testimony in front of your committee with a joke, but I really could not. I could not think of anything on this subject, so I apologize for that.
See how good looking the chair is. Yeah. That's a good joke. You start off just right.
So I want to address something. I see that Senator Sparks has left the room, but one of the things that I heard his question was about the ramping of natural gas. And one of the things, just I know from reviewing Xcel's report, what they said is they really couldn't quantify, but they and hopefully I'm paraphrasing what they're saying, and they correct me if I'm wrong, that they weren't really able to quantify what the costs were, because as you ramp these plants up and down, there is a cost or stress on your equipment. And so one of the things why we wanted to talk to the committee today was, when we were reviewing these reports, we noticed that there's a variety of methodologies, and we're not saying one is better than the other, but what we do want is some consistency. And when you have this variety of different techniques to analyze the data, it's hard to interpret, and it doesn't really allow for a complete and consistent analysis for the ratepayers. And what we believe one of the points of having these reports was is to show the ratepayers whether this was costing them, the RES was costing them more money, or if it was actually less, if it was less money, and we were actually saving money. So we're here today to say that what we'd like to see is some kind of uniform analysis procedure from all the different stakeholders. One of the things I'd like to point out in the Division of Energy Resources guide, they even said that some of the analysis that they saw was pretty simple, and it just compared the cost of renewable energy to the costs of renewable energy, the cost of their renewable energy to the cost of purchases from the wholesale energy market. And some of these, as we've heard from some of the other utilities, it was a very in-depth analysis. So there's a huge variety in the data that we're presented with, and we're concerned from a ratepayer perspective, at least, that we didn't really account for all of the costs that would be associated with meeting the RES. Another example is, as I previously mentioned, that addresses the question from Senator Sparks, the more wind you're adding to the system, with what we've seen with some of the utilities is the need for more peaking generation with natural gas. And the problem with that is you're relying on wind, which is not always a reliable generation source, and then you're also relying on the unreliability of natural gas prices. What we've heard is hopefully it stays low for the ratepayers of Minnesota, but you don't know based on with federal regulation if fracking is for some reason stopped in our country, the price of natural gas could go much higher. So with the fact that right now it's low and it benefits us, we don't know going forward what will actually happen. And what we respectfully ask of the committee right now is given the uncertainty in the data provided, if the committee would hopefully refrain from enacting any legislation this year. We think that right now the PUC is the best place to resolve this issue, and possibly having the stakeholders come together there and having people at the PUC where they have the PUC docket has the appropriate resources to analyze and promote a consistent method that everybody can agree upon. And we believe, and we do thank the committee, we think this is an important discussion to have for the ratepayers of Minnesota, and we hope we continue to have this discussion based on the RES. So, again, I'd like to thank you for Madam Chair and members of the committee for having me testify today.
So, Mr. Gerber, you're saying back to the chamber's position is to continue to look at the cost of renewables, not do anything drastic. Is that what you're saying, basically?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, yeah, we would say that right. The prudent thing would be to do is hold off on any legislation and based on the results of the studies, whether it's to take action because you think the costs have been higher or to take action because you think the cost is lower. We think right now the best thing to do is wait and digest the information. And when we have a uniform analysis, that would be the appropriate time to possibly take action.
Right. Couldn't agree more. And I think that was discussed at the very beginning of this committee last year, that we're going to take a nice steady hand to all of this. And that's appreciate Senator Benson's bill moving this forward. I think that was a very prudent, responsible way of looking at this. And we'll continue to look at this. And like I said, if the utilities and the members that spoke, if they could gather some of their information and make it a little more concise for us legislators that have ADD and need some help and don't have enough time to to read it, but it'd be nice to just follow this and keep a steady hand on it. I'd appreciate that. Are there any questions for Mr. Gerber? Senator McGuire.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Welcome, Ben. Mr. Gerber to the chamber. I'm just curious, as we think about all of these things, what would you say would be the bottom line cost to your to the ratepayers, and how do you balance that against, you know, effect on the environment? I'm just thinking, you know, 50-50, 60-40, 70-30. How would you say the chamber is thinking about these issues? Is cost like 90% of it and environment 10? Or I'm guessing chamber members care about, you know, a lot of different things. So I'm just sort of wondering how you're going to be thinking about these things.
Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair Rosen, Senator McGuire, thank you for the question. I'd hesitate to put I couldn't quantify an exact percentage, but I think when you look at our policies, we believe in reliable and affordable energy to our members. And I'd like to point out, you know, some of the utilities did put a percentage based on the savings. And when you see 1% might not seem like a lot to a residential ratepayer, but an industrial or commercial ratepayer could mean millions of dollars. And that's when we're starting to talk about jobs and economic impacts. So it's hard to put to more specifically address the question. I couldn't put an exact number, but I think it's important when you look at the percentages that we see of savings or costs to think about what that would mean on a larger scale to everybody, to residential ratepayers, to industrial, and to commercial.
So, yeah, Madam Chair.
Yes, in regard. I
probably didn't ask my question exactly correctly, but as you think about, you know, what emphasis you place on, say, cost versus environmental impact. What, when you're doing your analyses and when your members are thinking about these issues, would you say that they put, that they weigh cost 90% of the time and environment 10%, that they put much more, they care about cost 90% of the time more than they care about the environment?
I would think that would be a very hard thing to measure.
Yeah.
I think you'd have to go to each individual, and a company to speak for the entire individual.
It just seems
tough,
as though, thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems as though cost is the absolute number one thing, and so I was just wondering how much of a factor the environment does play in some of this.
Mr. Gerber.
Madam Chair Rosen, Senator McGuire, thank you again for the question. Again, I think you can't just focus on one aspect, because reliability, something that, forgive me if you didn't mention that, you know, reliability is just as important as cost and some of these other things. Because if you have really cheap energy, but you don't know when it's going to come and go, like a lot of countries, you have major blackouts, that can mean millions of dollars in lost time. Mm-hmm. So you have to weigh all of these options individually for specific businesses.
The other question, too, I think that should be looked at is the cost of the what happens when our wind power starts to age, the current maintenance, the life cycle of this, life cycle cost of it. It's certainly something we need to, you know, to make sure that we have a handle on.
Yeah.
And Mr. Bull, if you wouldn't mind giving it not only to a residential but to the large user, that 1.4% increase, kind of give a range of that would be beneficial to know how much it's costing your customers. Any other questions? Senator Benson, do you have any comments that you'd like to say about the results or the legislation or what you're thinking going forward?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity. I loved carrying this legislation last year as a freshman. It gave me a really solid chance to understand this important industry. I would like to see more consistency in reporting going forward. I thought the chamber did a good job indicating that we wanted consistency, but the results didn't come out that way. And I apologize as author of the legislation for not being more engaged in helping bring people together so we have some uniformity. But we have another shot with every integrated resource plan to get more consistency in understanding how the RES impacts us. Sounds like, in general, we're pretty locked into wind until at least we're hitting the 2020s. And because of the purchase power agreements, we're not going to get a lot of flexibility and rate impact. And so I think prudence going forward with the renewable energy standard is probably the best advice. The energy industry doesn't like big changes. And so I'll proceed carefully. I was looking at some possible changes, but a lot of good information here. I was taking notes furiously, had my highlighter out, and I'll be thinking going forward about how the RES impacts our energy policy short-term and long-term. And that's all I have to say.
Well, and the PTC may have an impact on that, unfortunately, too, which I'm afraid of. Any other comments? Deputy Commissioner Bill Grant is back there. Anything you'd like to say, Mr. Grant? Any other comments from the audience? Well, we could have gone a little bit longer because this is very good information, and really appreciate your attention and your work on this, all of you. Next Thursday, we're going to have our hearing on distributed generation. So we will have the Deputy Commissioner up there. And with that, have a wonderful weekend. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.